and welcome to Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Side Podcast. This is the second series, taking a look at those teams who are consigned to the history books for all the right and sometimes the wrong reasons. There'll be seven short shows over consecutive days and an omnibus at the end, but for now, let's look at our first Forgotten F1 team, Hesketh Racing. In the 1950s, Lord Thomas Alexander Fermor Hesketh was born, a baron no less. He was what you would call eccentric and didn't take too kindly to school. When he was 21, his family inheritance made him rich, and what better hobby to take up than racing cars? He teamed up with his friend Anthony Bubbles Horsley, and in 1972 they entered a team in the F3 series with few results. Then they met and signed up James Hunt. He had been ousted from the March F1 team, falling out of favour for being a bit reckless out on track. This suited the Hesketh ethos well, as the team soon garnered a playboy-style reputation. They celebrated with champagne whether they won or lost, turned up to events in flash cars, and ran without sponsorship just because they could. The team decided to test the water in Formula One, purchasing a March chassis and poaching ex-March designer Harvey Postlethwaite. Their first appearance was in 1973, with some good results, improving all the time. Hunt scored a second-place finish at the season-ending US Grand Prix. Lord Hesketh was encouraged by what he had seen. He converted stables at his property to build the next year's car, and he transformed a farmhouse into apartments for the mechanics to stay in while they did. The team spirit had never been higher, and Hesketh decided their F1 involvement should be a full-time thing. With a brand new car designed by Postlethwaite, the team scored 3 third places. There were plenty of retirements along the way, but they'd done a great job for a new team. Hunt finished the championship in 9th place that year. 1975 was similar, so much so they even used the same car. They did have a great opening to the year though, a second place in Argentina. Their first and only win came at the Dutch Grand Prix, where Hunt managed to hold off a Ferrari to take the top step of the podium. Hunt was a constant for the team, whilst they ran a second car with a succession of pay drivers, including Harold Ertl and Alan Jones. The new car was ready towards the end of the season, allowing Hunt to pick up some more points, and he finished 4th in the championship at the end of the year. That was the peak of the team's success, though. Lord Hesketh began to realise he was running low on money. He searched for some sponsorship, but with nothing major forthcoming, he decided to pull out of the sport. The cars were sold off, and James Hunt found another seat at McLaren, replacing the outgoing Emerson Fittipaldi. Bubbles Horsley wanted to keep the Hesketh name going and brought in Nigel Stroud when Postlethwaite followed his own cars to their new owner Williams. Horsley found sponsorship in the form of Rizla and Penthouse magazine, and he signed up Harold Ertl and Guy Edwards. 1976 was a poor year, and 1977 was very similar. Frank Durney had a go at designing a new car, but 7th place was the best that could be achieved. Surprisingly, Hesketh were still racing in 1978 when Olympus Cameras sponsored the team for female racer Davina Gallagher. She never qualified the car though, and was replaced after 2 races. Several retirements and failures to qualify later, and Horsley had to admit defeat. The team folded. The name continued on as Hesketh Motors for a while, producing parts for other teams. Meanwhile, Lord Hesketh tried his hand at manufacturing motorcycles, became president of the British Racing Drivers Club, and set up an airline, which was later sold. Hello and welcome to the second episode of the second series of Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Side Podcast. In these 7 shows, we're exploring the history of teams you might have forgotten, even if they weren't that long ago. Today, we're looking at Jaguar. Jaguar owners Ford had been a presence in Formula One for a while, supplying engines to Williams, McLaren and Lotus. In the middle of 1998, they purchased Cosworth, and the next year they decided it was time to up their involvement in the sport. They bought out Jackie Stewart for full ownership of Stewart Grand Prix, and rather than naming the team after the parent company, Ford decided to promote their higher brand of motor, Jaguar. 2000 was their first full season as a constructor, and they brought Eddie Irvine and Johnny Herbert on board to create and market an all-British team. They ran with a delicious green livery, which was actually the same colour as their title sponsor Beck, rather than British Racing Green, as you might have expected. The first few results were not great, and it wasn't long before the team was set for a restructure. IndyCar team boss Bobby Rahal was brought in to take the helm. He didn't have long to make his mark, though, before things were changing again. At the end of the year, Ford put Wolfgang Reitzel in charge of their F1 outfit, and he was determined to improve things by bringing in new people. He hired Niki Lauda with a job title of Head of Premier Performance Division. The Jaguar team fell under his jurisdiction. Rahal and Lauda disagreed over a lot of things, but particularly when Rahal wanted to bring Adrian Newey over from McLaren. They got as far as signing a contract, however, Ron Dennis persuaded Newey to stay with him at McLaren. This left Rahal embarrassed and in a difficult position with his team. After he and Lauda continued to disagree over driver Eddie Irvine, Rahal left the team. Their best result that year was with Irvine, a third place finish at Monaco. Lauda was fully in charge for 2002, but their campaign was even worse. With Pedro de la Rosa joining Irvine, the team saw 19 retirements out of 34 starts, and their best result was another third-place podium finish for Eddie at Monza. By now, Ford were beginning to realise just how costly F1 could be, particularly as only the Jaguar arm of their company was getting the marketing benefit, and the Ford name was lost behind the team. For the 2003 season, they slashed the budget and implemented a two-year time frame for getting increased results. The new cost-cutting regime saw Lauda made redundant, along with a large number of staff. Tony Purnell was brought in to replace him, whilst Mark Webber and Antonio Pizzonia were given the race seats. More bad results followed, with Webber occasionally managing to scrape into the points. After his fifth retirement at the British Grand Prix, Pizzonia was replaced by Justin Wilson for the remaining five races. Wilson fared little better, although he did pick up 1 point. For a little continuity, in 2004, Webber was retained, with Austrian driver Christian Klien taking the second seat. The team managed to secure sponsorship from Steinmetz with a film tie-in at Monaco. Promoting the Ocean's 12 movie, George Clooney was in the garage, and Klien's car was fitted with a massive and very expensive diamond in the nose cone at Monaco. What do you think happened? The car met the barriers at turn one and the diamond mysteriously disappeared. Insurance covered any monetary damages, but where did that diamond go, I wonder? Perhaps the team knew that their future was on shaky ground because 2004 was a year of fun. Two of the mechanics picked up an inflatable donkey, some merchandise from the Shrek films. For whatever reason, they decided to bring the donkey with them to all the races, taking photographs and publishing them on a website. At the end of the season, everyone in the paddock signed the donkey and it was auctioned off for charity. That was the best bit of publicity the team could manage, and by the end of the year, Ford made good on their ultimatum. The results weren't there, so they decided to sell the team. Webber left and moved over to Williams, whilst Klien stayed on with the new buyers, energy drinks giant Red Bull. It's worth noting that Webber returned to Red Bull in 2007 and races with them now. This is the third episode of Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Sci Podcast. In these episodes, we are looking at teams who aren't racing anymore but should be remembered either for doing very well or maybe floundering a little bit. Today, we're looking at Shadow Racing. The company behind Shadow Racing was founded by Don Nichols, a mysterious man with an unknown background. He set up his base in America and called the company Advanced Vehicle Systems. They produced a car and called it Shadow, ready to race in the Can-Am series. At the end of 1972, Nichols confirmed they would be making the step up to Formula One the next season with major sponsorship from Universal Oil Products, UOP. The team made their debut at the South African Grand Prix with Jackie Oliver and George Vollmer, two drivers brought along from the Can-Am team. They also supplied a car to Graham Hill, who was racing under his own Embassy Hill brand. Results were mixed. Vollmer had a great start to the season, on the podium at the team's second race. Oliver struggled with retirements until the penultimate round, where he equaled Vollmer's third. 1974 was a difficult year for the team. Peter Revson and Jean-Pierre Jarier were in the driving seats, but retired from the first two races. In practice for the next South Africa Grand Prix, Revson was killed when his car suffered suspension failure and crashed. The team withdrew from the weekend. After a couple of driver changes, Tom Price was drafted in to replace Revson. Once again, a third place was the highlight of the season, this time in Austria. A new year and some continuity with their drivers, Shadow introduced the DN5 chassis with a new Cosworth engine. The new car helped Tom Price win the Race of Champions, while Jarier secured pole position at the first two Grand Prix, although he finished neither of them. Midway through the year, the DN7 was brought in with a Matra engine. There doesn't appear to have been a DN6. It was raced for only a couple of weekends before Matra chose another team to partner. Shadow finished sixth in the championship, which was to be their highest position. The beginning of the next season saw UOP pull their sponsorship from the team, leaving Shadow with very little money to pour into development. The results suffered, with just one podium and a couple of points finishes, seeing them 10th in the Constructors at the end of the year. Jarier left the team after the season ended. 1977 was another turbulent year. Once again, the South African Grand Prix saw tragedy as Tom Price was fatally injured in a terrible collision that also claimed the life of a marshal. One car had stopped out on track and caught fire, and as two marshals ran across with fire extinguishers, Price came upon the incident unsighted. The accident rocked the team, but they weren't about to give up. Alan Jones was brought in to replace Price, and the team's results began to pick up. Jones scored an unexpected win at the Austrian GP, so unexpected that organisers didn't have the Australian national anthem ready for him. Jones also picked up a third place before the season was over. It was the second car that let the team down that year, with no less than five drivers having a go, between them only scoring 2 sixth places. At the end of the year, Jones left to join Williams, and quite a lot of the staff formed their own team in the shape of Arrows. The newly formed Arrows team were actually sued by Shadow for copying their chassis, and when the claim was upheld, Arrows had to redesign their own model. This may have been a blessing in disguise for Arrows, though, as results for Shadow Racing were now few and far between. 1979 saw the team use the exact same chassis as the previous year, and by 1980, the team was slipping backwards fast. After several races saw them fail to qualify, Nichols put a halt to proceedings and shut the team down. He sold the assets to what would become Theodore Racing. Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Sir Podcast. We are delving into the history books to find out about those teams who are no longer in the sport and trying to find out why. Today, we're looking at Tolman. Towards the end of the 1970s, businessman Ted Tolman began to get involved in motorsport, as well as a little bit of powerboat racing. He entered the Formula Ford 2000 series and was involved with the March team in British Formula 2. He hired Rory Byrne as a designer, but while Byrne worked his magic, he continued to purchase customer chassis. At the end of 1980, Tolman announced his plans to enter F1 for the following season. Byrne had designed the TG181, they had a turbocharged Hart engine and brought in drivers Brian Henton and Derek Warwick. It wasn't really a great debut year. Their season didn't start until the fourth round, and both drivers failed to qualify until Henton got through in Italy, the third race from the end. He finished 10th. Warwick qualified at the season closer at Caesars Palace, but retired from the race. The new car wasn't ready for the 1982 season, so the drivers, Teo Fabi replacing Henton, continued with upgraded 181s. They still managed to spend their time retiring from races or not qualifying in the first place. The 183 was ready midway through the year and was only used twice, but did allow Warwick to score the fastest lap at the Dutch Grand Prix. He retired from that race, though. Once again, the cars were updated for the next season, with Fabi replaced by Bruno Giacomelli. New sponsors were brought on board, including BP, and that saw an increase in budget. The results began to pick up, with Warwick scoring points in the last four races of the season. Giacomelli also managed 1 points finish, and the team finished 9th in the Constructors' Championship. For 1984, Warwick moved up to Renault, whilst Giacomelli was replaced by Johnny Cecotto. Warwick was replaced by the new and highly sought-after Ayrton Senna. Although they both retired from the first race in Brazil, Senna was soon picking up points and scored the team's highest finish at the Monaco Grand Prix. It was an incredibly wet race, so much so the running was stopped with only 31 laps completed, not even half distance. He finished second behind Prost in the McLaren, and many people wondered if he would have won had the race been completed. At the British Grand Prix, Senna was again on the podium, scoring a third place. Cecotto, however, crashed heavily during qualifying and broke both his legs. His season and his F1 career was over. Tolman ran just one car for the next three events until they got to Italy. By this time, Senna was being headhunted and had signed with Lotus without telling his team. Tolman was not impressed and suspended Senna for the Italian Grand Prix. They brought in Stefan Johansson and Pierluigi Martini to race, with Stefan finishing fourth. Senna was back for the last two races, and he and Johansson finished the season together. Ahead of the 1985 season, Tolman suddenly found themselves with tyre supply problems. Way back in their Formula 2 days, they'd upset Goodyear by switching to Pirelli for improved performance. In the midst of 1984, they did the same thing to Pirelli, preferring the Michelin rubber. Unfortunately for them, Michelin withdrew from F1 at the end of the year. The only reason Tolman managed to find a supply was because rival team Spirit had folded, allowing them to step in and take the Pirelli tyres. The issues meant they missed the first few races, and although they had planned to have Johansson in their single entry, he moved on before they got going. Teo Fabi was brought back in and spent the first few races retiring. Midway through the year, Tolman did a deal with Benetton to become a major sponsor for the team. They immediately began to run a second car with Piercarlo Ghinzani behind the wheel, but the results did not improve. They scored no points that year and suffered a heck of a lot of retirements. At the end of 1985, Benetton brought out Tolman. They renamed the team Benetton Formula and kept Fabi on for the next season. In 2000, the team was bought out by Renault, but that is another story. Welcome to Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Side Podcast. We're looking at those teams who deserve a place in the history books, whether it is for greatness or mediocrity. Today, we're getting right up to date with our fifth team, Spyker F1. The roots of current Formula One team Force India F1 start way back in 1991 with Jordan Grand Prix. They have been through several iterations in recent times, and today we're going to talk about just one of them. Jordan was bought by Midland F1, who were bought by Spyker. Spyker Cars are a relatively new Dutch automotive company, although the name dates back to the early 1900s. This new modern version of Spyker was founded in 1999 and they build high-performance sports cars. They did have a little motorsport experience building and running GT cars. The key to their entrance into Formula One seems to be with Michiel Mol, a wealthy internet entrepreneur. He had previously sponsored Jos Verstappen and wanted to further his involvement with the sport. His new deal saw him invest in Spyker Cars to help them invest in F1 to the tune of over $100 million. He became their director of F1 racing. The deal with Midland was completed midway through the 2006 season. Current drivers Christian Albers and Thiago Monteiro were kept on whilst the team set about trying to change their name. The regulations frown upon mid-season name changes, so Spyker stuck to being a title sponsor, Spyker MF1 Racing. Midland boss Colin Collis was retained as team principal. At the end of the year, the changes started to happen. The car became orange, the national colour of the Netherlands. Mike Gascoigne was brought in as chief technology officer, and the team became officially known as Etihad Alda Spyker F1 Team. That's Spyker to you and me. They also switched to customer Ferrari engines rather than Toyota. Albers retained his seat with the team, whilst Adrian Sutil was brought in to replace Montero. They signed up four test drivers. Four: Adrian Vallès, Mohamed Fares Fawzi, Guido Vandergaard and Marcus Winkelhock. That's a lot of test drivers. Vandergaard's confirmation as test driver came out of the blue for everyone concerned, including Super Aguri, who said they had a contract with him to be their test driver. The case went before the contracts recognition board and Vandergaard remained with Spyker. He was going to be their official reserve driver, but did not get his super license through in time. Results weren't great, with the driver's average finishing position about 14th. There were plenty of retirements along the way as well. Midway through the year, Albers was let go as his sponsorship money failed to come through in time. Christian Kleen was tested for the seat, but Spyker decided to let Marcus Winkelhock behind the wheel for his home race at the Nürburgring, the European Grand Prix. It was a rather wet race, and thanks to some lucky tyre choices and a timely safety car, Winkelhock managed to lead the race for a couple of laps. Thanks to some unlucky tyre decisions, Winkelhock didn't lead for long and he later retired from the race. Although some great publicity for the team, this wasn't enough to secure Winkelhock the seat, and Sakon Yamamoto was drafted in for the remainder of the season. The team were developing a new car, which initially failed its crash test before passing it after modifications. The extra work, however, delayed the introduction of the car until Italy. It wasn't until Japan that Spyker saw a turn in fortunes. It was another wet race and half the field retired, but Sutil managed to finish a credible ninth. This was even better for the team when a round of post-race investigations saw Liuzzi given a 25-second time penalty, promoting Sutil into eighth place, their first championship point. By this time, Spyker Cars were already in the process of selling the team. Michiel Mol teamed up with Vijay Mallya to form a consortium called Orange India to buy the team from Spyker, and they were successful. Mallya turned up at the Chinese race as a proud new team owner. They were renamed Force India for 2008. Welcome to Forgotten F1 Teams, a mini-series brought to you by Sled Podcast. We are looking into the history books to discover some of those teams that are no longer present on the grid and telling their story. We're on to our penultimate team now, and it is Andrea Moda. At the end of the 1991 season, shoe manufacturer Andrea Sassetti bought the ailing Coloni F1 team. They had failed to pre-qualify for every single race for two seasons, but Sassetti clearly thought he could change their fortunes. He kept a lot of the Coloni staff on and signed a deal with Simtek to run a car previously designed for BMW. He signed up with Judd Engines, and thus Andrea Moda was born. Their new car, though, wasn't ready for the start of the season, so they turned up to the South African Grand Prix with an old Coloni chassis. Alex Caffey and Enrico Bertaggia were drafted in to drive the cars, but neither of them pre-qualified. As it turns out, it didn't matter, as the team were excluded from the event. Sassetti had been contacted by the FIA and asked to pay the $100,000 due for a new team entrant. Andrea refused to pay, arguing that he was not presenting a new team, but had bought the Coloni entry. In the end, he had to pay the fee, despite previous teams in similar situations not having had to do so. At the next event, the Mexican Grand Prix, the drivers and team turned up prepared to race, but their cars were again not ready. This time, they did not participate in the Grand Prix, and neither driver stuck around for the next few races. Roberto Moreno and Perry McCarthy were brought in. Moreno didn't qualify for the race, whilst McCarthy was refused a super license and also didn't race. The team's first entry into a race came at Monaco, with Moreno finally reaching qualifying. He started 26th, but retired after only 11 laps due to engine problems. In Canada, the team found themselves with no engines, as Sassetti had failed to pay his bills with Judd. Instead, they borrowed some Judd motors from Brabham, but neither driver qualified for the race. By this time, people were starting to leave the team, and things were getting a little bit embarrassing. Ahead of the French Grand Prix, a protest by local truck drivers caused chaos. All the teams were affected, but it was only Andrea Moda who didn't make it to the race. With so little in the way of results and so much in the way of not showing up to races, any sponsors the team had began to rapidly withdraw. Short of money and beginning to realise what a challenge he had set himself, Sassetti began to favour Moreno. At the Hungarian GP, there was a guaranteed space on the grid due to other team movements, and it was an easy decision for Sassetti to make. McCarthy was let out of the pit lane with just 45 seconds to go, meaning he had no chance of setting a decent lap time. The favouritism was so obvious that the FIA, or FISA as they were then, issued the team with a warning. They needed to make the effort with McCarthy to show they were at least trying, or they couldn't compete. Once again at Spa, pre-qualifying was unnecessary as the Brabham team had pulled out. Both cars made it into qualifying but were at least 15 seconds off the pace. During that race weekend as well, police entered the paddock at Spa and arrested Andrea Sassetti on charges of fraud. He had allegedly been forging invoices. The team were turned away from the paddock at Italy and banned for the rest of the season for bringing the sport into disrepute. Welcome to the last in the current series of Forgotten F1 Teams, brought to you by Sled Podcast. We've been travelling through time and looking at teams from across the decades, examining their history and why they are no longer around. Our last team is Van Wall. Tony van der Velde was a businessman, creator of the thin wall bearings, and he was originally one of the sponsors of British Racing Motors, otherwise known as BRM, in the 1940s. He didn't like the way the team was run, with so many decision makers, and decided to form his own team. A decade later, he was ready to enter in the new Formula One Championship with the cars known as Van Wall Specials. The name Van Wall was a mixture of his own surname van der Velde and the thin wall bearings he created. Designed by Owen Maddock, built by Cooper Cars, and with their own in-house engine, they made their first appearance in the 1954 season at three races with Peter Collins behind the wheel. He only finished one with a seventh place. In 1955, Van Wall Specials ran with Mike Hawthorne, Ken Wharton and Harry Schell, not all at once. They scored three ninth places out of eight starts, the rest were retirements. By the end of the year, it seemed clear that the engine was good, but the chassis was holding them back. Van der Velde decided to hire a designer to work some magic, and it was none other than Colin Chapman. Chapman teamed up with aerodynamicist Frank Costin and engine designer Harry Westlake, and they prepared a new car for the 1956 season. Stirling Moss was brought in to race in a non-championship event, which he won. He was still contracted to drive for Maserati, but he was convinced to join Vanwall in 1957. Tony Brooks and Stuart Lewis Evans were also signed up, and that preempted a record-breaking moment. At the British Grand Prix that year, Brooks and Moss shared the drive. They qualified third on the grid at Aintree and successfully brought the Vanwall home in first place. It was Vanwall's first win, Brooks's first win, but also the first victory for a British driver, or two in this case, at the British Grand Prix with a British car. Brooks completed 26 laps and Moss 64, and they shared the 8 championship points between them. Moss went on to win the Italy and Pescara GP and finished second in the Drivers' Championship. Ahead of the 1958 season, alcohol fuels were banned, which caused Vanwall some serious engine cooling issues. They had to redesign their engine, gearbox and brakes to sort this out, but they were successful. All three drivers had stayed with the team, and Moss and Brooks each won 3 championship races. Vanwall became the first ever Constructors' Champions as the title was introduced that year. The driver's title was a much closer battle, with Stirling Moss taking on Mike Hawthorn in the Ferrari. At the season-closing race, Moss took the victory, one of his 3 wins that year, with Hawthorn a close second. But Hawthorn won the championship by just 1 point. There was more bad news to come, though, as Stuart Lewis Evans was in a terrible accident. His car suffered an engine failure that saw him crash into the barriers and his car burst into flames. He was airlifted from Morocco back to the UK for treatment, but died 6 days later from burn injuries. Their constructors' victory was overshadowed and Vandevelle was devastated. He was also not in the best of health, with doctors advising him to rest more. In January 1959, he decided to quit the team. Vanwall tried to continue, appearing at a few championship and non-championship races, but the results weren't good and the enthusiasm seemed to have been lost. In 1961, Lotus tested out a Vanwall engine, but aside from that, the name was gone from Formula One. John Surtees drove a Vanwall in the Intercontinental Formula Series that year, but it was not a successful entry and that soon folded as well. Tony Vandevelle kept out of the public eye after leaving the team and he died in March 1967. That's all for this final episode of Forgotten F1 Teams. We've profiled 7 teams, but if you've got suggestions for any future episodes, please let me know on the site, sidepodcast.com, or email me, Christine@sidepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.